It was conducted in the medicine home of his friend Richard Hartzman. I think to start with, I'd like to hear a little bit, though, about your early life. I know that you were born in Vermont, and then you went to high school in Seattle. So I'm wondering how you got from Vermont to Seattle. Yes.
Well, I lived in Vermont until I was about, about eight. I was born in 1897, November, and lived in Vermont until 1906. And when the San Francisco, my father had been traveling for Macmillan Company in New York State. And in 1906, when the earthquake hit San Francisco and reorganization was desirable, the company sent him out there to take over that office. And housing was scarce, and my sister was engaged to a young man, and my father and mother wanted to make sure that it was the real thing, so they wanted to separate them for a year. And Dad said to Mother to take me and my sister abroad for a year or so. So Mother and sister and I went to Europe and spent about a year in Germany, where my sister, who was an excellent pianist, studied under a well-known German instructor, teacher. And I went to a private school in Berlin, and then later a public school in Leipzig. And sister came back, and Mother and I stayed on for another 6 months traveling around. I remember being dragged through every art gallery in Europe and coming to hate Madonnas, which Mother was very fond of, and also develop I'm getting over the reluctance to enter an art museum because I just want to see what's inside now. Well, let's see, then we came back and we had this great big home in Rutland, and Mother sold it, and went out to join my father. Lived in Berkeley for 2 years, about, I think, and then he transferred up to Seattle with another company. And I lived in Seattle, went through the last part of the eighth grade, high school, and the University of Washington. And after graduating there, I tried business for 6 months. Thoroughly hated it and went back to teach. I'd majored in economics and had a good deal of accounting and went back and taught accounting for 2 quarters and shifted my interest in study.
Where did you teach accounting? At the university?
University of Washington, yes. And shifted my interest in study to psychology, which I'd always had some interest in, along with philosophy. And I got a year of, I guess it was 2 quarters of psychology, all but got a master's degree, except for writing a thesis. And during that year, I won a Rhodes Scholarship, and the following fall, I went to Oxford. Now, what else?
Well, then, I guess it's a matter of record where you studied from then. Do you want to talk briefly about the period before you came to Wisconsin?
Well, what happened between Oxford and Wisconsin?
Well, it's sort of a time lapse
Yeah, there is quite a lag. I went to Oxford in 22, was there from 22 to 25, and didn't come to Wisconsin until 44, so there's something of a 20-year period there. If you want me to run over it, all right. Well, I spent 3 years at Oxford and came back to this country. My first job was at Dartmouth College, and after a year there I was offered a job at Reed College because my old professor at University of Washington, from whom I had elementary economics, was going on leave, and he remembered me and offered me a job of filling in while he was gone. And I was happy to do it because the work was more interesting and more varied than at Dartmouth. So I went out there for a year, and I got married just before I started at Dartmouth. Left Reed and went back to Harvard for my graduate work. I was there, as a student with a small scholarship first, and then there from 27 to 32, where I was an instructor and tutor the last 4 years, and got my degree in 32. And that was the depth of the Depression, of course, and I was very lucky in getting a job at the University of Cincinnati, where I stayed 8 years, interrupted by 1 year in the U.S. Treasury. And at the end of 8 years, I was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship and went to Chile took my family with me, my wife and two adopted children. We spent the year down there. I was researching on the country and got out a little book, I think one of the first books on economic development, called it Chile. What was it? Let me see. Well, I can't remember. Chile something, and just right now the name skips me. It'll come.
Yeah, we can check that.
One symptom of my age is I can't remember names sometimes.
Well, you've got lots of company there.
Yeah, lots of company. All right, I came back from that, and well, of course, I was there 41, 42, and Pearl Harbor struck while I was there. And at the end of the year, I was offered a job in the Board of Economic Warfare, and they wanted me to get back to that, so I did. And to make a long story short, I did something, I think, rather exceptional. And well, anyway, that's it. After about two or three months in my job, I was chief of a division called the United Nations Division in the Board of Economic Warfare, which was mainly a research outfit. I went to many meetings of Lend-Lease and War Production Board and State Department and all the agencies. And after a couple of months, I decided that except for one small unit of five men out of about 100 in my division, all the work that was being done by my division was being done better, or at least as well, in some other agency of the government. So I recommended that my division be abolished, which didn't make me popular with my superiors, who were empire builders.
I see.
I shifted over after a few months to State Department, a lower rank, assistant division chief, and was in that for a while, and then shifted still further. I won't go into the details of that, but I stayed on until 44. And then President Dykstra at the university,
yes,
urged me to come back. I was getting bored with the work in Washington, and the war looked as if it were going to end fairly soon.
Have you been working with Dykstra during
No. I had some connection with him. I've forgotten what it was, but he knew me, and I knew him slightly. And he wanted me to come back and get the department, to be chairman of the department, and sort of get it ready for post-war operation. But I didn't want to be chairman. I had plenty of administrative experience by then for my satisfaction, and I didn't want any more, so I just consented to come back. I forget who was made chairman, but anyway, it wasn't me.
Well, this would have been after Keefover. Would it have been Groves, or was it?
I don't know. No.
That was too soon.
It was after Keefover, yes. It was 44. I don't know. Frankly, I just don't remember who was chairman. But anyway, I was there 44, and that was the thing of interest perhaps to your archives, is that that was the time when economics and commerce were together, all one lump run
yes,
together.
Yes, commerce was still in L&S,
yeah,
wasn't it?
And there was a big question within the group, which consisted of people that were in both areas. The big dispute was how to divide up the work. What courses were to go to commerce, and what courses were to stay in economics or go to economics. And that involved a good deal of disputation. And I recall very vividly that Walter Morton and I were almost always on the same side. And in what became our department, Groves, who was a very good friend, and witty too, and Mr. Perlman, were on the other side. They were anxious to hang on to as much as they could. And Walter and I felt that many of those courses they wanted to hang on to were intellectual deserts, and why not let them go to commerce? We finally went out. Walter and I went out, and in most cases, we kept what we thought were intellectually respectable courses and let commerce have. Well, it isn't really a matter of intellectual respectability, because it seems to me the division is between courses that apply to the whole economy and courses that relate to specific business practice, management courses. But in that instance, there was a good deal of disputation about courses that we felt really had no business in economics. I think we got one or two of those, to my regret, but most of the division came out pretty well.
Well, I know it ultimately did become, commerce became a separate.
Well, yes, it came within the next year or so. Commerce became the Commerce School and Economics, Department of Economics.
So that was the initial.
That was the initial area of disputation, you might say.
But can you tell me about some later ones? I'm well aware that the commerce, that the economics department continued to have.
Well, we had problems. The worst one was one which ranged me not with Walter Morton, but against him.
Well, how did that come about?
Well, increasingly, Walter became more obstreperous, and after, a short time, I don't know, two or three, four years, it became almost impossible to get any business done, because he'd bang the table and really almost yell. Students could hear him way down the hall, and really intimidated the department chairman. I think at that particular period it was Mr. Whitty, and he just couldn't get any business done. And finally, Dean Ingram and Ed Young, now president of course, who was then chairman of the department, hatched up a scheme to make Walter Morton a university professor outside the department, which his course is not required, but open to students that wanted to take them. Now this would have gotten him out, and no voice in the department, no need to be at department meetings, in fact no right to be at department meetings, and it would have gotten rid of this this problem. Another thing was that he was inclined to wash our dirty linen in public by his close friendship with Mr. Evue.
I guess he did write letters and so forth.
Wrote letters to the editor, and then Evue would expand on them, and it was not very pleasant. There was this scheme, and we were to have a meeting in Mr. Fred, the then president's office, to discuss this matter, and it was Mr. Ingram had told Ed Young that Mr. Fred was willing to go along with this proposal. But suddenly, when just the night before the meeting was to occur, he called Ed up, and Ed called all of the group up, Mr. Ingram having said that you'd better call your men up and get them together, warn them that Mr. Fred is getting cold feet about this proposal. So he warned us, and we all went to Mr. Fred's office the next morning, wondering what was going to happen. Well, Mr. Fred started off with a rather ambiguous question as to, what problems are bothering you in your department, when the obvious one was the Morton problem. And Ed Young started it off, being chairman, of course, by detailing the problems he confronted, that the business was very difficult to conduct. And when he got through, there was a pause, and I thought, I'd better jump into the breach, or this may slide off. So I jumped in and said I'd been there at that time. This was 57. I've been here 13 years, and during most of that period, that's been almost impossible because of Walter's conduct to get any business done. And as I mentioned earlier, he pounds the table and yells and is just obstreperous. In fact, one year, Dean Ingram had to come in and take over the chair at our meetings in order to make them run at all. Fantastic situation. So, Mr. Fred listened to all this. It went down the line. The only person who spoke up for Walter was Mr. Glazer, who was a close friend. Even Selig Perlman, who was a mild-mannered man, sided with the majority, the outstanding majority. And, no action was taken or indicated by Mr. Fred. But anyway, we all went out to Jim Early's and got pretty high that night. And strangely enough, from then on, we had peace in the department. Walter sort of crawled into his hole and pulled it in after him.
Was he aware of this?
Very much so. At this time, he was in Puerto Rico on vacation, I think it was. I don't know, maybe this was happening in Easter vacation. But anyway, he was in Puerto Rico. And he came back, and one day he confronted me in the hall and says, "I understand you've been knifing me in the back." I said, "You want to know what I said, Walter?" And we went into his office, and I told him precisely what I told you just now, and what happened there, and exactly what I said. And for a whole couple of years, he didn't speak to me. And then gradually, he'd start grunting, and finally, we became friends again. And on this visit here, we've been very cordial. So it's worn off, I'm very glad to say.
But he was never made a university professor.
No, nothing was ever done. He just, this was apparently enough of a slapdown so that, I guess he was sensitive enough to shut up. Much of the time he didn't even come to meetings. In fact, he rarely came to meetings, which was in a way a shame, because Walter's a very bright man. and could make useful suggestions, but if he would make them and not raise hell over it.
Was there any sort of consistent position that he took during these years when he was disrupting the
I don't remember that there was a well, all kinds of things came up, and he would make a big noise about it. I don't remember, because where I sided with Walter was in the first two or three years when this matter of commerce separating from economics came up, and there was a good deal of disagreement about the division of courses, of areas. But later on, it was one thing after another, and I don't particularly remember any specific issue. Let me think. Well, often it was a matter of standards on passing PhD candidates, because Walter and I had, and particularly at that time, Martin Bronfenbrenner, had different views about standards of PhD candidates, about what should be required. You want me to go into that at all? Because that involves personality.
Well, yes, I would be interested in that.
Right.
I was going to ask you about him.
I always felt I respected particularly Selig Perlman for his intellectual ability, and Witte for his legal craftsmanship. After all, he was the father of the Social Security Act. But I felt that both those men were lax in their judgment of graduate students. And so did Martin Bronfenbrenner, and so generally did Walter Morton. And we three voted as a block generally in the meetings, Martin and I always, and Walter sometimes. I remember one case where Witte wanted to pass a man on the grounds that he had four children and would lose his job if he didn't pass his prelims, to which my comment was, what's that got to do with this examination? We're supposed to judge his attainment in economics and not his social status. Maybe he should be running a filling station. Another case was, a remark by Selig Perlman when we were discussing these matters, which I was very surprised at because he's a man of great intellectual attainments. And he said one time, who are we to judge? To which my reply was, Selig, who else? That's one of the things we're paid for. Oh, I do remember another very vivid case that came up the other day about which Jack Barbash was very nice. I had lunch with him and some other men in the department. There was an Iraqi student, one of Jack's, and he was coming up for he'd just taken his prelim, and he was a very weak candidate. It seemed to me there was no question but that he was just awful. And Martin Bronfenbrenner and I were standing firmly against his passage, but the plea was that he'd threatened to commit suicide if he didn't pass his exam, to which my reply was, well, if he's that neurotic, he's going to commit suicide anyway, so we shouldn't let it concern us in the least. But however, the committee passed him. He promised not to come back, and I understand that now, some 15 years later, he is here on sabbatical from some job he has in Iraq and wants to go on and get his doctorate to finish his thesis.
But he hasn't committed suicide.
Still, he has not committed suicide. I was sure he wouldn't.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Jack was very nice about it. At this lunch, I told these stories about Witte and Perlman rather mischievously. I was curious to see what Jack's reaction would be. And he was very nice. He said, you clobbered me once in a meeting like that.
Oh, did you?
Well, this was it, this Iraqi.
Oh, I see.
That's what he had in mind. He was very, very nice and amused at the recollection of the thing. And he mentioned this guy was back here wanting to get his thesis out of the way now.
Do you recall any effort that you can think of to get Walter Morton to leave the university?
Oh, no. No, we weren't anxious to get rid of him. No, we just wanted him out of the department.
Out of your hair, so to speak.
Out of our hair, yeah. No, he as a university professor, he would have retained his rank, his tenure, and everything else. But he would have been out of our hair, as you put it. That was all.
You mentioned Bronfenbrenner. He did leave.
Oh yes, Bronfenbrenner. Mm-hmm. Well, he was a strange character. I've always been very fond of Martin. We got along fine. He has a very fine intellect, and but he has a tendency to put his foot in his mouth, and he felt that he'd offended Dean Ingram by one of his rather abrasive remarks, I guess, and thought he had better get out of here, so he went to Minnesota. But he was restless. I think he had itchy feet. He went from Minnesota to, Carnegie Institute of Technology, it was at that time, in Pittsburgh. It became Carnegie Mellon later. And I think he for a time at Michigan State, and then he finally went to Duke, where I understand he is now and is very happy. But he moved around a good deal.
So you think he would have done that anyway, regardless of the situation
probably,
here?
Yeah, I think he was. I think he was mistaken about Dean Ingram, because Dean Ingram is a generous man. I don't think he would take offense at minor abrasive conduct.
Probably not.
No.
From what I know of him.
Well, Bronfenbrenner Brenner was a sensitive guy, and maybe he overreacted to things. I was very amused. I'm now at San Diego, and where I taught one course in the San Diego State University for 3 years. Bronfenbrenner and I keep in touch through Christmas notes, and he sent me a note the first Christmas I was there, addressed to University of California at San Diego, saying at the end of his letter, "I'm sending this to this institution on the grounds that it's the more reputable of the two, where you, I presume you will be," which of course I wasn't. That department was far too mathematical for me. They would have had no use for me.
Oh, that's interesting. What do you mean by too mathematical?
Well, economics is becoming, has tended to become, or has become, much more mathematical. In fact, the journal, the main journal, American Economics Review, is becoming so mathematical now, I can hardly understand. Well, of course, this is probably a result of the feeling that a science is a science only to the extent to which it can be quantified, and you can't quantify a science unless you, or it doesn't do any good to quantify it in terms of just gathering statistics unless you can generalize from those, and for that you need mathematical formulations. So there's a reason for it, and only the trouble is that the mathematics is getting ahead of the statistics. You can't always fill in your formulas, and when you have equations, when you have empty equations, it doesn't help a great deal. A lot of the work is, of course, what we call model building, and you don't have to have a mathematical equation for that, but you can make it more precise with them, so that accounts for a good deal of it, I think. But my mathematics is limited in scope. Consequently, I've been left behind. Of course, I've been retired for 11 years now, and it doesn't bother me. Lack of mathematics did bother me for quite a while, but I managed to get by, and though I regret I didn't have more earlier, it's no great matter at my age.
Has this become a general trend, or are there two schools of thought?
Well, it's become a general trend, but I think there has set in now something of a backlash against excessive mathematics, and more conviction that there is room for political economy, which is more related to policy and doesn't rest upon mathematical formulations of rather elaborate but often inapplicable models.
How did the department here stand in relation to this?
Well, this department I don't think ever has been overwhelmingly mathematical, even now. It's become more so because that's been the trend throughout the profession. But in San Diego, the UC San Diego Economics Department started off as a highly mathematical oriented department because the first college there, Revell College, was aimed at the sciences. And the economics department was put in that. Now they have developed service courses for some of the other colleges which are not science oriented, but they still are heavily mathematical as a department.
But this did not ever become a divisive issue here, for instance?
No, I don't think so. Not to my knowledge, anyway. It may have after I left.
Now, somebody else that I think left was Eugene Rotwein.
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 Yeah. Somebody left with him?
No, didn't he leave the...
Oh, yes, he left
the
university.
Do you recall any of those circumstances?
I don't recall the occasion. I think I'm not sure that he left before I did. I guess he did, yeah. But I don't know the reason for it. I don't recall it anyway.
Another thing I'd be interested in is what role Elizabeth Brandeis played in the department.
Well, she was a very non-mathematical person and concerned primarily with the social aspects of economics, and very good at that.
I know her position was sort of a little unusual in that she was part-time and a lecturer.
Yes, she was part-time. I don't know whether that was... I think that was probably from choice. After all, she was married and probably had other duties. Undoubtedly had other duties, and maybe that was all she wanted to do, wanted to take on.
Did her opinions carry some weight in the department?
Yes, I think always. She was a respected person.
And I know she was there for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
You've talked about some of the people. Who were the people you felt closest to?
Well, Martin Bronfenbrenner, for one. Mm-hmm. And early on, Walter Morton. Jim Early, especially Jim Early. He's now out at Riverside, and he and his lovely wife, Betty, have been, well, almost like brother and sister to me out there. And, let's see. Well, I always liked John Corbell very much. He was here, but was let go and is now at New Hampshire. I was sorry to see him go, the reason being that he was not a research-oriented person, and they felt that he just wasn't... Well, it was publish or perish, and he perished.
That sometimes happens.
Yeah. Well, there were many others. I like Gene Rotwein very much. Sorry to see him go, and sorry to see him and his wife divorce. What else? Who else? Ted Morgan, of course. Always been a very close friend. So he came here, I think, in 47 or thereabouts. So we had a long relationship, a very happy one together. And I got to know and like very much Dave Johnson and John Culbertson. In fact, all of the group that was here when I was. Bob Baldwin came in rather late, so I didn't get to know him as well as the others, but I liked him very much. In fact, I felt this way about the department the last few years I was here. It was a very harmonious department, and I was very pleased with it. The people got along beautifully. We had disagreements, but they were always handled with care and sophistication and decency.
Sounds like something of a change.
Very much so.
How do you account for it? Is there anything beyond...
Partly that we had very nice people there. Morton was sort of paranoid. I think that was the source of the problem. Whereas all of these people were well-balanced and very sensible individuals. There was very little rancor. In fact, no rancor that I can recall in the last 10 years or so.
One person we haven't talked about, of course, is Ed Young.
Yeah. Yes, I've known Ed and respected him very much indeed. He has a real talent for administration, obviously.
Was he chairman right away? I mean, did he come as chairman of the department, or was that somewhat later?
I don't recall. You'd have to ask Ed that. He became chairman very early on. He was one of my students, actually.
Oh, he was?
Oh, yeah. I had him in class. He just took one course from me in the international area. His area of interest, of course, was labor. He just happened to drift in and take a course. And I knew him as a student, and then later on as a professor, and then as chairman of the department, and then, of course, as chancellor, and now president. I recall Dick's excellent statements on frequent occasions. He really really was a moving force in our faculty meetings. You could always count on Dick to stand up and say something worth listening to.
Whereas you did not tend to do this.
I was a little, slow in getting on my feet and talking in meetings. I was much better at committee meetings where matters are more informal. I guess maybe it was a matter of a little bit of shyness. I don't know.
Were you on any committees?
Very few. I avoided them whenever possible.
Which few were they?
I don't even remember.
You don't even remember?
No.
There was something I came across about an integrated course that you gave at some point with, the information said with Professors Dangerfield and Hartshorne and Dick said he thought he remembered that James McCready of Political Science also was part of that.
I remember participating. It was just a matter of my giving three or four lectures, that's all. Bringing in economics along with geography and political science and so on. I don't remember very vividly what the focus was.
Well, I think that it had something to do with your having had dealings with the War College or something of that sort.
My only dealings with the War College were a couple of lectures I gave there once.
Well, maybe that's all it took.
No, I'd had some experience overseas. Maybe that was brought in. See, I was here actually from 44 until 67, which is 23 years, but I was attached to the university, but I was on leave for five of those,
mm-hmm.
Working for the World Bank or the United Nations, in one instance, visiting professor at the University of Hawaii. So I had some experience with economic development in the field, and maybe that was called in, I don't know.
Very, very likely. Then I think I also read that you gave some lectures in the contemporary trends.
You probably did. I don't remember. I was called on to give lectures every now and again, but, I gave quite a number of even extension division and that sort of thing.
Did you give them around the state?
Two or three, yes. Two or three early on. I think they got fed up with me after a while.
You left in 67. What was your feeling about the university at that time? This was a rather...
Well, I left just before the roof fell in. I left in the fall, in the spring, June of 67. And that year there had been some turmoil in the Commerce Building. Not really a riot, but some noise and commotion. That was just the beginning of it. But the next year, as I say, the roof fell in. Everything began to happen. And I was fortunately out of it then.
Did you stay in Madison or did you leave?
No, I left in June, went out to Riverside.
You went right away?
Right away. Jim Early, you see, had been offered the chairmanship of the department at Riverside and was going out. And I had canvassed a number of universities out there. I didn't want to quit teaching entirely yet. I was interested in teaching maybe one course. And I'd had two or three nibbles, but Jim said there's an opening in the international field at Riverside. Why don't you come along? So I did, and I got there, and somebody else quit who was in the economic development field. So I ended up by teaching full-time, which was two courses, which is rather nice.
Very nice.
And I taught there 2 years, and my wife didn't like the smog or the heat of the summer in Riverside, so we looked around and decided to go to San Diego.
You said something earlier about this one situation with President Fred. I'm wondering what you thought of him as a president.
Well, I like Mr. Fred very much as a person, and I understand that he was especially good at in his leadership of the university in dealing with problems with the legislature, the regents, extra-campus sorts of things. But I thought he was not as strong as he might have been with internal matters like this. It would have been very helpful if he'd stood up and backed us up in this situation. But maybe he was right after all, because it turned out Walter Morton's reaction was to shut up and stay away from department meetings. So it, the results, as far as we were concerned, were just as useful as if he'd been made a university professor. Maybe Mr. Fred was right.
Possibly. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, Harrington, though, was a great contrast to him.
I don't remember much about, well, not having been active in university affairs, I don't remember much about Harrington's activities, although I knew Fred as an individual.
Did.
Hmm.
He was quite a backer of Young, of course.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad of that.
You don't know anything about what it's about Young's coming back, for instance.
Well, I remember that he was at the University of Maine, as president of the University of Maine, and he was brought back here. I don't know, was he chancellor immediately?
Not right away, but I think that Phil Sewell was chancellor, I think, when Young came back.
Oh, yes. That's right.
And then when he left, he was only chancellor for 1 year.
I see.
And then Young, I guess,
took over
after that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know he was chancellor during the balance of those years of turmoil here.
Yeah.
Over the Vietnam War.
Ed stepped into that, and then right in the middle of it.
Yes, exactly. Is it? It already
really,
was going full force when...
The bombing of Sterling Hall happened under Ed's administration.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
Has he talked about that at all?
No, he hasn't. Actually, he hasn't. We've had a chance to reminisce, but he's been so busy. One whole day away, day and a half at Washington. Now he's just taken off. I just saw him yesterday, and he took off to the north for a short fishing well, not vacation, 2 days into vacation, but short fishing interval. So we haven't had as much time to talk as we would have liked.
No, it wasn't much fun. Are there any other things that come, anything in particular that comes to mind that you feel was particularly significant?
If not, I want to thank you very much for being willing to take some time out from your brief visit to Madison to make this recording.